Oh, so it's a pleasure to be able to speak on this day in honor of Boris, who's made so many contributions in the subjects I'm supposed to talk about, CP violation and neutrino physics, and particularly in making things, clarifying things. I know that when I came across this idea that there were CP eigenvalues for Maron and neutrinos, I said plus one, minus one, and he let me know it was plus I and minus I. But the real thing that has noted that's so remarkable about Boris is that we've known him all, known him as a theoretical physicist, but really all the time he was leading a double life. He was really a secret, well, not so secret, agent of some government agency. It wasn't the CIA, but some other government agency. And so that really is a remarkable thing that he's been able to do that. Now, finally, as you know, he's liberated and is free to spend all his time on theoretical physics. Not quite, it turns out. He's a prime candidate to be on committees. And I learned from a quote in Vicky Weisskopf's autobiography about committees. A committee is where you keep minutes and you lose hours. Okay. So a lot of what I have to say is may have been said in other talks. I thought I'd start by reviewing a little bit about CP violation. CP violation was discovered some 40 years ago, and we now have three numbers that measure CP violation. And this graph shows the rate of discovery in CP. For the first 25 years, this is the rate of discovery, for the first 25 years, one number, epsilon, which was originally measured in 1964. Then, in the next 10 years, Fermilab and CERN decided to agree on the value of epsilon prime, so that rate of discovery went up, and then the rate of discovery in 3 or 4 years, the B factories measured sine 2 beta. So the rate of discovery is going up very fast. Now, it's known that extrapolating a curve from 3 points can be extremely dangerous. So we do not know whether it's going to continue to go up like this, whether it's reached a plateau, or whether a peak remains to be seen. Now, these three numbers epsilon was the first, that measures CP violation in K mixing, is 2 times 10 to the minus 3. Sine 2 beta can be thought of as the epsilon for the B system because it measures CP violation in BB bar mixing. It's something like 0.7. And epsilon prime for the kaon system, which is 4 times 10 to the minus 6, represents the only evidence for CP violation in a decay process and represents what we say is the first evidence against something called a super weak theory, which says that all the CP violation would be confined to mixing where a very small interaction could produce it. Although I sometimes say that it's so small that it represents a slap on the hand rather than a blow to the head of super weak theories. The next goal, really, I believe, in CP violation at the quark sector is to measure what I call epsilon prime for the B system. That is to measure CP violation in the decay of the B. Because that is expected to be very large. Now we have today a standard model of CP violation, the CKM matrix. This, again, in the quark sector. This matrix tells in the weak interaction how the down quarks couple to the up quarks via this 3x3 matrix. Or you can say, since, of course, by definition, the weak interaction is diagonal in flavor, that this represents the matrix that relates the flavor states to the mass eigenstates. Now a key, and this matrix, of course, has one phase which is not removable and has physical significance. When, in fact, the 3x3 matrix was invented by Kobayashi and Miskawa, because at that time there were, one thought the matrix was 2x2, in which case there was no place for CP violation. So they said, let it be 3x3, and then you can have a meaningful phase. Now, a key to this matrix occurred when one found the lifetime of the B meson and realized that this has a hierarchical character. That is, this is a lambda is the sign of the Kibibo angle. We knew that that was 0.22. But then it turns out that this element, the B to C coupling, the main ways the B decays, is of order lambda squared, and then B to U is still smaller in order of a lambda cubed. So it can be, this is a truncated version. If you make these substitutions in this, it's exactly unitary. This is truncated, but for most purposes adequate for the CKM matrix. And then there are four parameters, lambda, A, rho, and eta. And one has a rough idea of what these parameters equal today. The that's indicated here, and eta has to be something like 0.3 or 0.4 in order to explain epsilon, which is in the and also now signed to beta. So we have a fair idea, although not, of what the magnitude of these are. Let me see what I mean by epsilon prime for the B system as being the thing we want to measure. This matrix can be thought of having two large phases. This phase gamma up here, and then the phase beta here. And those are large phases because they're in the terms of order lambda cubed, and then eta is has to be something like 0.3 or 0.4. So those are large phases giving this unitarity triangle, as it's sometimes called. And the thing that's been measured, sine 2 beta, which is the phase of this element, comes in via BB bar mixing, because this couples the top to the down, and the virtual box diagram with a virtual top is a thing which determines BB bar mixing. And so this is the phase of BB bar mixing. If you then look at some decay, which has no phase in this representation, the B to C, then when you measure the asymmetry due to mixing, when you have this decay process, you get a term sine del MT due to the oscillation of B to B bar. Why? You'll get a difference depending on whether you start with B or B bar, which is all due to the mixing, and it's sine 2 beta. And that I call epsilon for the B system, not because it depends on this phase convention so much as it is the first evidence, which you can blame entirely on mixing. However, one expects for B to U transitions, a large phase in the decay amplitude, or a large relative phase of these two decay amplitudes, and that you will find by measuring what I call epsilon prime for the B system. That is, by measuring the same asymmetry, but now for this decay instead of that one. And it should be very different because of the fact that this involves B to U. Now, there's also something called a penguin diagram, so it's not really just given by this. So that if you measure that asymmetry and it's different than this one, then you know this CP violation, the decay amplitude. The present experiment at Babar tells you that this asymmetry is zero, but there's large errors still. If this asymmetry is zero, that's an indication of CP violation of the decay amplitude, sort of paradoxical. You see no asymmetry. Very good. That means there's a large CP violation of the decay amplitude. because it's not the same as this one. It's just the difference between the two that tells you that there's CP violation of the decay amplitude. So that is, in some sense, the thing we want to measure. And that would then indicate that there really is large CP violation in decays of the quarks, and it's not anything like super weak. Now the question is, where do we go from here? What is the thing we most want to do, first in the quark sector, and then I'll get to the lepton sector. What do we want to do? And countless papers say we want to measure these parameters more accurately. We want to know exactly what gamma is and beta. We want to know these exactly what rho and eta are. And they always say in my talks, I called, named them rho and eta, and I don't care very much what their exact values are, so why should you? What is the real point? So this is a summary I've given in talks about what I see as the long-term frontier for CP violation. The first and crucial question in the quark sector is to find if there's anything beyond eta. Is all CP violation described by one parameter eta? Or is there really other, do we really have other signals of physics that goes beyond that standard model? And CP violation is a very good place to find it. For one thing, as I said, this standard model has made one prediction of a semi-quantitative sort that sine 2 beta is greater than a half. That's its only victory, in a certain sense. So there's a lot of room. And since mixing is in the quark sector is due to what are called box diagrams, there's lots of room for new particles to enter into those. There are loop diagrams called penguins, which also are susceptible to new particle effects. So that is what one really wants to do. One wants to see if all the physics in the quark sector is described by this one parameter, eta. And the way to do that, of course, is to measure these parameters, beta and gamma, rho and eta, in different methods, not to know exactly what they are, but to find disagreements between the different measurements that may say, or agreements, as the case may be, that tells you either that there is new physics or that everything can be explained by eta. So that's the real goal, is to see. Now, a whole other kind of thing I don't have time to talk about, but is also a very important frontier, and that is to look for effects which in the standard model are very small, both in the lepton or quark sector. That is to look for electric dipole moments, which are notoriously small in the standard model. Then the other frontier, and the one I'll talk about in the rest of the talk, is CP, and we've heard a lot about already, is CP violation in lepton physics, and that in particular in neutrino mixing, analogous to what we found in the quark mixing. So that's a whole frontier. Then there are two other much more fundamental questions which aren't clear to me how we will answer them. One is whether CP violation is really a spontaneously broken symmetry. CP a symmetry at all? Is it a symmetry or just an accidental symmetry? When we started looking at things in particle and physics and field theory, you wrote down a Lagrangian, and then you noticed, oh, this thing is CP invariant. Not because you made a postulate of CP invariance, you write it down, you write QED, it's there. You write other theories, it's there. In fact, you write the standard model with four quarks and it's still there. And then you finally say, oh God, well, there's six quarks, we write a crazy Yukawa coupling, and it's there. From the standard model point of view, CP was never there. You violate CP everywhere you can, which means you also have this crazy thing known as theta QCD, which is all there too. So you would like something more fundamental. And the fundamental idea, one of them certainly, is that CP is a symmetry and that it's spontaneously broken somewhere. But how we'll find out about that remains to be seen. Finally, of course, there's this great hope. It's a thing we advertise, probably advertise a little too much, that CP violation at some high mass scale may explain the baryon asymmetry. And of course, at this conference, we do it by leptogenesis. Okay. So, Let me come now to the lepton sector. And there is, I think, to me, something which has been striking for a long time in part physics, and that is what appears to be a symmetry between the leptons and the quarks. Find it, it's quite striking. They come in three generations, the SU2 doublets, there's a mass hierarchy among emu and tau. So it is a striking symmetry. It, of course, is a broken symmetry. Over the last 50 years, we've all learned to love broken symmetries, even if we don't quite understand the breaking so well. Now, it's clearly a broken symmetry. If you can't tell the difference between a lepton and a quark, you're in very bad shape, or very, very energetic. That's a subtle joke. Okay. There exists a grand unified theory, which Ravi Mahapatra talked about the other day, SO10. And SO10 not only unifies all the SU3 plus SU2 plus U1 interactions into a single interaction, but it also unifies the fermions all together in a 16-dimensional representation. And my own feeling has always been that those are equally important about SO10. I always had a repulsion feeling about SU5 because of this terrible representation the quarks are in. Here they're in very nice 16-dimensional representation. Now, SO10 can be broken down into this famous SU4 cross SU2 cross SU2, SU4 the Padi Salam, SU4 of color, SU2L, the one we all know and love, and then SU2R. Now, the SU4 of color, of course, has to be broken down to the SU3 of color. The lepto quarks among the generators, 15 generators here, become very heavy. You're left with the massless gluons and QCD. But there's a question of what to do about the neutrinos. That's also a signal of the lepton quark breaking. The symmetry broken because the neutrinos have practically no mass. They're very different from the other particles. So that's another aspect of the breaking of the quark-lepton symmetry. And that was a question that Gell-Mann, Ramon, and Slansky, in the context of SO10, worried about at Aspen in 1977. And they came across this idea that among the breaking things in the breaking that would happen is that you would get a large mass for the right-handed neutrino, leading to the seesaw formula, which they never published, but which is in even perhaps more quoted unpublished papers. So, the seesaw formula, everybody knows, says that the neutrino mass comes in the form of the Dirac matrix. That's the standard matrix that connects left to right. But then there's this very large right-handed mass, and then everything's suppressed by that, and then MD transpose. So that's the seesaw formula. Now, from the lepton quark symmetry, one might expect that MD is something like the quark masses. Just as a charged lepton masses look something like the quark masses, so then that's part of MD. MD should look something, not necessarily exactly alike, because we're trying to understand the breaking of the symmetry, but the big effect of the breaking of the symmetry is this MR. MR has nothing to do with quark masses. In the simplest version, SO10, this Dirac corresponds to a coupling of a complex Higgs in the 10 representation. If you want to get a right-handed Majorana mass, you need some effective 126-dimensional representation. So the result is, of course, that this has M nu isn't. The lepton quark symmetry is broken by this MR, and there's no reason to expect M nu to be anything like the quarks. Having said that, one has to admit that we all expected that the neutrino should have a mass hierarchy and should have small mixing angles. I wrote a paper that said that, even though we knew the symmetry is badly broken. There were arguments like saying, well, there are two MDs and only one MR, so the MD should win out. Anyway, the real thing is, of course, to find out. We want the clue to how it's broken. And the clue, of course, is that the mixing is large, not small. As we've heard many, many times here, the mixing is large. There's this large mixing in the solar mixing, the solar mixing angle being solar mixing angle squared, something like 0.3. And then this large mixing between nu mu and nu tau, here I took it as being maximal. And one small angle, this famous S13, I have more to say about. And then the phase analogous to the phase in the quark mixing matrix. Now notice, in a sense, the quark lepton symmetry, at least in the form of the seesaw formula, makes us expect there should be CP violation here, because we expect to see some phases in MD, and unless they sort of mysteriously canceled, there should be something left over here. How big, we can't say. But we expect there should be a phase there. And so it's great interest to find what would be, both because if we could find CP violation in the lepton sector, we would have twice as many parameters as we have today. We only have one today. So we'd have a second parameter to describe CP violation. And of course, it would also perhaps be a clue for understanding this breaking of the quark lepton symmetry. Now, as Sergei told you, there are 9 parameters if we have a Majorana neutrino. There are the 4 parameters in the mixing matrix, the 3 angles and this one phase called the Dirac phase, because even if it's Dirac, the neutrino, we have that phase. Then there are the 3 masses. And then if it's a Majorana, we have these 2 phases that Sergei talked about, which we cannot remove as we can in the case Dirac. Furthermore, even if CP is not violated, I put these in the mass matrix, because if you take this unitary matrix and diagonalize the mass matrix, you'll get, in general, these complex results. Doesn't mean the mass is complex, but it means these are meaningful phases. Furthermore, even if CP is conserved, some masses may come out negative. That also is a meaningful thing. It means the relative CP eigenvalue of the mass eigenstates, which also is a significant quantity. Now, just a comment about the matrix. I don't know that it has any particular significance. If you use as basis states not nu mu and nu tau, but the sum and difference, then the matrix begins to resemble the CKM matrix. And that follows some things, the various things people have talked about here. So you have this block, which is the Kibibo mixing in the CKM. That's the big mixing there. We have here the big mixing, which is a solar mixing. It's even bigger. The Kibibo angle is a little less than 15 degrees. This angle may be a little over 30 degrees, but this is the big block. And then you have these small numbers in the CKM matrix. This is the lambda squared. This is lambda cubed. And here you have small numbers. This small number is, of course, the S13 we've talked about so many times. This, what I call epsilon 12, you know, that's the right designation. But this is supposed to represent the fact that the mixing may not be quite maximal. So the deviation, that's the quantity, was epsilon in Steve's. So this is the deviation from maximal. And then from unitarity, you have to have some small quantities down here. So that makes it look something like the CKM matrix. I don't know that has any particular significance. One thing, which of course we hope it doesn't have significance, is that this is lambda cubed. Its magnitude of this quantity squared is 10 to the minus 5. If S13 squared were 10 to the minus 5, all the experiments that C. Park talked about and other people will talk about tomorrow are dead. So what's undetermined, and this repeats what people have said, what's undetermined today? We know the mass differences, or we can find the mass differences once we know the mass scale, let's say M1. So we don't know what that mass scale is. There's a famous mixing angle S13 and its phase delta. There's a discrete ambiguity. Whether it's a so-called normal hierarchy looking like this, or whether this state and this big, which is this big atmospheric mass difference, this is actually the lower state. There's a very important question whether neutrinos are Majorana or Dirac. And finally, of course, if they're Majorana, there's those two additional CP violating phases. And again, I think in the seesaw, even though I think even if we don't know anything about MR, we still, in general, will expect, because of the Dirac mass phase, to see some phases in the these Majorana phases. Now, so what about seeing CP violation in neutrino oscillations due to this phase delta? Well, the obvious thing to think about is to look at the difference between nu mu to nu e and nu mu bar to nu e bar. Many, many graphs that Steve Park flashed by rather rapidly. The rate is proportional to S13 squared. That's crucial. If S13 squared is too small, even though he touted that S13 could be very, very small and you see a huge effect, but you'll see no rate. That's more important sometimes to experimentalists than to theorists about having a rate to detect. So that's the most crucial issue. The rate is proportional to S13 squared. If S13 squared is too small, this is all gone. The second thing is, of course, that this difference depends not only on this large difference, delta m squared 3.2, but also on this delta m squared 2.1, which is 40 times smaller, the solar mass difference. And you have to have both of them. If this goes to zero, then it's like a 2x2 case again, and then there's, again, no CP violation. So because this delta m squared 2.1 has to, you have to be sensitive to that, you need, and this corresponds to then a long oscillation length, you need a long baseline or very low energy or some combination thereof in order to do this. The third point, of course, is that in matter, this difference is not a signal of CP violation. If you do an experiment from nu mu to nu e, you have to go through the Earth. If you now want to apply CP, you take nu mu bar, goes to nu e bar, going through the anti-Earth, going through antimatter, which turns out to be inconvenient. So you don't, can't really do the direct sign, directly measure CP violation in that sense. So what you have to do is calculate the effect of matter. You can do that pretty well. Not, there's some uncertainties due to what you do know or not about the profile of the Earth. You calculate that matter effect, and then eventually you fit the data to this S13 and delta and these other parameters like this epsilon and all the other parameters and do a wholesale fit, and you find delta. And you say you've discovered CP violation. It's not a direct test of CP violation, but you fit the data and see that the only way to fit it is with this delta. One might say, in passing, of course, that you assume you understand the matter effects. That is, that you're using the standard model. One of the things one has to always keep in mind is maybe there's some matter effects which you have on neutrinos that haven't been discovered yet, like flavor-changing neutral currents. When I first wrote about matter effects 25 years ago, the thing I was thinking about was flavor-changing neutral currents. I got into this whole matter effect business by saying, are neutral currents diagonal? The standard model says, yes, when neutral currents occur, you don't see a neutrino coming in and you don't see a neutrino coming out, so it must have been the same thing you didn't see twice. Well, that wasn't proof. How could you tell if the neutrino coming out or the same one coming in? And then thought, well, the coherent forward effect, you would see gradually a transformation, even with no mass, due to flavor-changing neutral currents. Well, we don't believe that explains the present data. thing that Sergei described, the massacre, killed that explanation. People had said, Valle and others suggested that you could explain solar neutrinos entirely by flavor-changing neutral currents. But nevertheless, in the long run, in analyzing data, one should take that possibility. I don't think one should start by assuming that. But one of the things you can do is limit flavor-changing neutral currents. But in any case, analyzing these experiments of neutrinos going to anti-neutrinos, you have, in a sense, to assume you know the matter effect, take it, include it, and then fit the data to find delta. Now, it's also possible, as people have noted, that you can do experiments where the matter effect, which simulates CP violation, making new bars different, is relatively small. You can choose distances and energies, so the matter effect is quite small. And so, if you see a difference between neutrinos and anti-neutrinos that's quite large, you know it's due to CP violation. Then finally, you could look for T violation and compare nu mu to nu e to nu e to nu mu, so that you then have no matter effect. I put it in quotation marks because you have to assume that the path is symmetric between the detector and the accelerator. Again, it's quite inconvenient to interchange accelerator and detector. But through good approximation, you expect the path to be symmetric. So that, of course, requires a neutrino factory. Well, there are countless papers that discuss these experiments. This is just a random sample of papers. There are probably hundreds of them. This is a miscellaneous sample. What's perhaps interesting is the different kinds of proposal. There was even one for very low energy, 50 kilometers. Don't know how practical that is, 100 MeV. There's the JEHF, this JEHF2 to the Hyper Kamiokande, 300 kilometers is 7/10 of a GeV, long baseline accelerator experiments, neutrino factory experiments, all sorts of energies, and all sorts of distances. But that's just a miscellaneous sample of all the papers. Now, the crucial point is the following. What's S13 squared? If S13 squared is too small, all that's fantasy. So it's terribly important to measure S13 squared, like it's been said by other people, and I've been shouting it for several years now. That's the crucial question. What's this? How big is it? There's a limit from the Shor experiment, which is something like this, depending a little on delta M squared. What can we do in the next 10 years? Now, two experiments we know will go on. One's this Minos experiment. As Steve Park mentioned, it's particularly badly suited to do this. So this is the most important issue, Minos experiment that costs a lot of money, and it's particularly unsuited to do what is the most important thing. Of course, part of the problem is fact, one had to decide 10 years ago when one didn't know that this was the one most important thing. There's experiments turned to the Gran Sasso that also is not particularly well suited. Those experiments can perhaps, the Minos and CERN Gran Sasso, perhaps can improve this by a factor of 2 or 3, but that's at best. So what could be done within the next 10 years? And these are 3 possibilities. The one that's closer to approval is the Japan Hadron Facility going to Super Kamiokande, a very good detector, and one which will have its phototubes back by 2007. And it would be something like 6/10 of a GeV, 295 kilometers. And at least some of the papers say that it could go down by a factor of 10. That's sort of the goal. The exact factor really depends, obviously, on details of how the beam will be and so forth. However, the neutrino beam has not been financed yet. It's not clear then when a neutrino beam will really exist there, hopefully by 2008, so that in 5 years it might be able to do this. At Fermilab, we've heard a lot about the off-axis proposal. Adam Parra was here a couple of weeks ago and discussing this, and Dave Klein in his talk. The off-axis beam means that you take the Minos beam, so you already have the beam. Instead of taking it straight on as it's heading to the Sudan mine, you take it off-axis a little bit, which gives you a variety of possible locations. That gives you a much better mono-energetic beam. You put then you need, however, a new detector designed to see the NUIs. The new detector just goes on the surface of the Earth. You don't really have to be underground, other than perhaps to protect the inhabitants of the region who think they're being bombarded with neutrinos. But if you can find a nice quiet farm, any place will do because of the very good time structure of the neutrino beam. And so this could, again, in 10 years, if it was approved, get down to this, provided a big enough detector, an adequate detector, was financed. But that proposal at the moment is still somewhat in limbo, coming off and on various lists that people write down. It also needs money. In addition to being on a list, it also needs money. Then at CERN, the Icarus, which is a detector, liquid argon detector, we've heard about it for 20 years or more, but it seems that it's going to be built. There's one module now. But they need a different beam. Not the present high energy beam is not the suitable beam. So we would have to make a new beam at Fermilab, and that, Andre Rubio says, again, can go down. So there are 3 possibilities within 10 years to push this down by a factor of 10 from the Schull limit. And it's the most important thing. The endless discussion of all these possible experiments doesn't make much sense unless this number is big enough. So those are the ones I think that could do it. Also, and this is very important, the goal of these experiments is not to find the limit on S13 squared, it's to discover it. That is to find that it's bigger than this number. For that purpose, you need at least 2 experiments. You can get a limit from anybody's experiment. But you discover something, and then all hell breaks loose. Mr. Klapto has discovered that. Okay. Speaking of Mr. Klapto, the other very important thing, which I mentioned many times, is neutrinoless double beta decay. Neutrinoless double beta decay should occur from around a neutrino via this diagram with a mass insertion. The mass insertion is proportional to MEE, the diagonal element of the mass matrix. That's equal to a weighted sum of the three mass eigenvalues, weighted by the probability that that mass eigenvalue is a new E, and multiply by these relative phase factors. This is where these phase factors come in, because they have to, you're trying to derive from the mass eigenvalues and the these probabilities, you're trying to derive a particular element of the matrix. And for that, these complex values matter. So, just to give an example of what can happen, suppose one does determine that MEE is 2/10 of an EV. That has to be derived from measuring the rate of double beta decay. And so, if you know the nuclear matrix element. If it's that large, we have this so-called degenerate case, because the mass differences are small, so it means that all the masses are about equal. Now this UE3 squared is very small, so if first approximation, you should forget that, and so you'll get simply that this 0.2 eV is cosine squared theta times N1 plus sine squared theta sun times N2, forgetting about UE3, multiplied by, well, the relative phase is the thing that matters. If these numbers are 1, no CP violation evident, then M1 is 2/10 of an EV. If, on the other hand, CP is not violated, but these have opposite CP eigenvalues, then you get cosine squared theta minus sine squared theta, or cosine 2 theta, and then you get, solving for M1, that M1 is 5/10 of an EV. So what you learn, if you observe double beta decay, neutrinoless, first is, of course, the very important thing, neutrinos are Majorana. That's enormously important thing to know. But you also learn, provided, which seems very reasonable, that the decay is entirely due to this diagram, that then the mass must lie between 0.2 and 0.5 eV, somewhere in between. Now, if it really is in between and not at the two endpoints, then you've observed the CP violation. For example, if the cosmology people told you that M1 is less than 0.5, and someone did tritium decay and said, well, it's certainly greater than 0.2, then it would have to be in between, and you could say there's a Majorana phase. Now, there are, of course, great problems, of which perhaps the most obvious one is that this number 0.2 will have a certain error due to the failure of the nuclear physicists to calculate that famous nuclear matrix element. And if that error is a factor of 2 or more, you're in deep trouble, obviously. So the chances of really doing this are quite small. One other thing, perhaps just to comment, since the cosmologists keep pushing down this limit, the cosmologists already tell you this is the mass of one of these. They already tell you the sum of the masses is less, I forget what they tell you. Anyway, each mass is less than 0.3. So it's interesting to ask, if this were to happen, and the cosmologists were to tell you, well, M1 is less than 1/10 of an EV, what do you do then? And you have two choices at that point. One is to say, there must be some other physics contributing to double beta decay. People have various things, right-handed neutrinos, triplet Higgses. I mean, there are lots of people who will invent something for you. Other new physics could contribute to double beta decay, or this cosmology limit is too severe. There's things the cosmologists haven't thought about. But that's a sort of amusing possible scenario. Okay, conclusion. What is the important thing for future as far as neutrino mass and oscillations? There are two important things that should be at the frontier. One is probe that value of S13 squared. Two, search for neutrinos double the beta decay. Those are the two important frontiers now. If one finds S13 squared is large enough, then you have the possibility by studying nu mu to nu e in various experiments to find the CP violation phase delta and to determine this hierarchy. If MEE is large enough, you'll determine the neutrinos are Majorana, you'll determine a range of M1, and you'll be sensitive to, but it's not clear whether you can discover, that there is a Majorana phase. Finally, of course, one wants to explore the possibility of physics beyond this, I know if you call it a standard model, a standard paradigm, sterile neutrinos, flavor-changing neutral currents, and things like electric dipole moments of the electron, of the neutron, all of which would be signals that there's something beyond this picture. Thank you.
Comments? Questions? Paul?
Lincoln, so in the distant future, if we wanted to measure or determine alpha and beta from a mean experiment beyond what would that experiment be?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think neutrinos, frankly, as far as I know, neutrinos above double beta decay is the most sensitive thing there is to these phases alpha and beta. I mean, they're very, very hard. You can imagine, but you have to imagine all sorts of different new physics, I think, in order to find them coming out. People write things, but I mean, within the, certainly, as far as this picture goes, that's the only thing I know that's really sensitive to these two these phases. So it's not easy to find them. Boris?
At the risk of entering into the realm of speculation, do you have a prejudice about the range of beta 1-3, where it really is?
It is
speculation, but...
I think the answer is no. I don't have... of course, having already written and said the other mixing angles were small, it's clearly bad to speculate. And the point is, it really has to do, in some sense, the whole thing is a signal of understanding this breaking of the quark lepton symmetry. We don't totally understand it, and therefore, I don't have any. You?
We can always take a poll.
not to be a great way to decide the laws of physics. Other questions? Comments? Sergei?
Nicola, I mean, it's a bit historical. Now, we know that it was you who found out that when CP is conserved, Majorana neutrinos can have CP bearings plus or minus.
Yeah.
Now, what led you to this? How did you arrive at this?
How we arrived at this question of the sign,
right,
as I think really, as I say, there are a couple of ways it came. One way it came, we were doing with Powell neutrinos, radiative neutrino decays, and it comes in there in this question of whether eventually you get E1 or M1 transitions. Also, I had this interesting experience when I was trying to look at double beta decay in the Z model. And I did a detailed calculation, and to be honest, being not very clever, and the answer came out zero. And which of course was obvious since the element was zero, but I didn't know that. And then trying to find out what that meant in the context of the Z model, it was clear that there were minus signs in that formula. So those are two of the ways this came up. Yes, Bill.
Just a comment on the beta 1-3.
Yeah. Yes, you'll get your chance tomorrow.
I mean, you gave the impression, and you intend to, that we should just concentrate on beta 1-3 and not worry about these other things until we know what the value of beta 1-3 is. And then we'll be able to intelligently decide how to proceed. Now, unfortunately, the neutrino programs you outline to get to beta 1-3 will take at least 10 years. And so you're sort of asking us to wait for 10 years before the next important input affects our planning. And that's a hard thing to do, to wait 10 years. And so I think it's worth emphasizing that whatever the value of beta 1-3 turns out to be, which I think is an expansion of what Steve had to say earlier, yeah. Whatever its value actually is, in this big range that he talked about, the ability to do CP violation is not dependent on what the actual value is. And so that you can plan for a CP violation experiment without knowing exactly what value is. One generally has the impression, the bigger theta 1-3 is, the easier it's going to be to do CP violation. Well, it's not going to matter what the value is up to a certain point where it's true. If you can't see new oscillations, you can't do anything. But if you can see...
The point is that they symmetry...
No. What is the point of theta 1-3 that you can't...
Oh.
What's the borderline?
That's the plot that Steve Schultz shows.
How far, the question, there's a question of how far down you can go, and that's an experimental question. And it has to do, obviously, with the question of the size of the detector, the beam, and above all, the background of nu e. This, you see, the statements made there that the asymmetry goes up with 1 over this S13, the rate goes, is the square of S13, and it's known, I wrote in my thesis, that in front, that the error, in a way,
that's the asymmetry.
Yeah, that's this asymmetry, that the error in an asymmetry experiment, if you get the square root of the number of the, for the rate, but you the asymmetry squared is the important thing. So you, in a sense, the fact that you're going up in the asymmetry, 1/(theta 1-3), and the rate is going down with (theta 1-3)². The figure of merit sounds like it doesn't depend, but that's of course if there's no background, and it's somewhat misleading in a sense. You get a very large asymmetry for (theta 1-3) being very very small, and but you have huge problems of background.
Why do you say it's misleading?
Well, because of the background, you come to the background
that's
issue.
Why. When you hit the backgrounds, you can't measure nu e anymore, and the argument breaks down.
Yeah.
Until you get sizable backgrounds.
Well, it's a how sizable? I mean, the backgrounds are real. So the question of what rate you need is really the question. What kind of a rate do you really need so you can do that experiment? I don't know what that answer really is. Some people discuss very low rates, particularly for neutrino factories. But the point is, if you don't know at all if theta 1-3² is really zero, it's very hard to say I should build a neutrino factory. So the real question is, what kind of intermediate things can one do at a reasonable cost? And Bill will tell you tomorrow.
Sue is gesturing frantically, but since it is Boris Kaiser Day, I'm going to allow Boris the final word on this.
Thank you. I just wanted to make an historical comment.
Yeah.
Since the issue of the parities, the CP parities came up, I was thinking about the CP parities many years ago, and consistently getting nonsense. I couldn't understand how it works. And then I had a conversation with Lenam Chang, and he said,
"He was sitting behind you."
Ah.
So don't say anything bad about it.
I wasn't going to. He said, you know, you have to consider that they're not plus and minus 1, but plus and minus I. And that's where actually I got the idea.
Okay. Very good. Let's bring this session to a close. The conference organizer would like to have a group photo taken on the front lawn.
which I assume is over there, right?
That's where
we're at. So would everyone walk in this direction and have a group photo taken?
And the sooner